We are Missouri Farm Bureau Insurance, and we're for the people of Missouri. We're for brewmasters, stockbrokers, beauty queens, and truck drivers. Whatever you do, if you're a Missourian, we're for you. We are Missouri Farm Bureau Insurance, and we've got Missouri covered.
Welcome back on the Sports Saturday here on Sports Radio 810. The soothing guitar that brings us into this, which you won't be able to hear if you're listening to this on the podcast, but that's okay. Just imagine soothing guitar music. I have to imagine is just sort of out here for all the KU fans that are tuning in to hear Scott Chasen of 24/7 Sports. Go all the KU stuff just straight to fog.net. Follow him on Twitter at Chasen Scott. Just things to bring down the blood pressure of KU football fans. Although, Scott, at this point, do you think many KU football fans have like stress issues by KU football being mad, by being bad? Because honestly, today's game was a little bit jarring, but I feel like at this point, they're probably used to it, right?
Sorry, I missed half of that question. I fell asleep listening to the stylings of Jason Mraz mixed with Jack Johnson. I think, you know, look, here's the thing, and I've said this now for, you know, a few weeks, and that's not to say, like, I'm any great prognosticator, but I can, you know, watch what's going on in the field, digest it, and think about it, especially when you're watching a game over and over. Today was kind of the example of, like, Kansas looked, in my opinion, outside of one area, so much better than the score was. Now, the problem was that one area was the entirety of special teams,
right,
including punt returns, punting, kicking, and they looked so bad that it wasn't like, oh, you just didn't look very good in all these different areas. It was like, I have a group chat with two of our staff writers, and we plan out content. We talk about, you know, stories. I was asking, like, is there some way to prove whether or not that was the worst performance in the history of college football in terms of special teams? Because Kansas must have punt. Kansas missed the field goal. Kansas allowed two return touchdowns and four returns of 40-plus yards. Kansas was down to its third punter. Kansas's best two plays on special teams were a punt by the quarterback and a running into the kicker penalty that set up another punt that was returned for a touchdown. It was one of the most insane things I've ever seen. And quite frankly, Kansas's offense until the third quarter was right there with Kansas State's offense, which I thought was played poorly. Kansas's defense was in the first half great and then kind of fell apart in the third quarter. But the special teams were so historically bad. So bad that you didn't even ask about them, and I feel the need to make sure I get that in on the first comment, because quite frankly, that was a stunning special teams performance. I don't care how many players they were down, stunning special teams. That is unbelievable and historically bad.
And I was going to get to that because it deserves the opening monologue, essentially, because I do think that through basically Twitter, I'm just gonna say Twitter, and it might expand beyond that, but I think through Twitter this game is looking like a damnation of Les Miles and where the program is right now, and I knew that was going to be unfair based on a conversation we had, whatever it was, 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, about some things that I want to circle back on. But specifically in this game, like, you just laid it all out. It may have been historically terrible special teams performance in a way that totally derails any other conversation that could reasonably be had about this game. Like, I hope you guys find a way to quantify exactly how miserable it was, because it seems so outrageous.
Yeah, I think about this. You're down 34-7 at halftime, and you've allowed one offensive touchdown.
Yeah.
Think about that. Think about hitting the over on over 48 on an over-under in a game that has three offensive touchdowns at the time. And
incredible.
Going over 48. I mean, that is insane. I coming into this game is hilarious. I was dead set that the under on under 48 was absolutely the right pick. I even wrote in my prediction, I picked Kansas State to cover by 20, but I said I feel better about the under. And if you take away special teams,
yeah,
and I guess a pick six, like, yeah, it was that was a fantastic kick and call by me. You know, oops, special teams can result in a few touchdowns. And, you know, again, it's just crazy to think about, because I mentioned that 34 points allowed in the first half, and only seven of those came from Kansas State's offense. Like, let's get one thing very clear. Going into halftime, and considering Kansas missed a field goal, you probably felt, if you're Kansas's offense and compared to Kansas State's offense, you'd be like, either I can't tell the difference or the Kansas offense is actually better than the Kansas State offense. Now, that didn't hold up. Kansas State scored a few touchdowns in the third quarter. And let's be real. Kansas State's offense is better than Kansas's offense. We can be, you know, let's be just real and upfront, and that's what that is. Mm-hmm. However, that's not how the game was unfolding, and yet you look at, you know, a pick six on a play where a freshman quarterback makes the wrong read. Two kick return touchdowns, including the second one, right before the half. Les Miles, I guess, told the punter. Now, I'll back up and set the stage. Kansas's starting punter, who's a great punter, Kyle Thompson, mm-hmm. was on the did-not-dress list. So I'm going to assume it was maybe a COVID contact tracing-related reason. Other than that, I don't know, but he's expected back next week. So I really couldn't tell you what that exact reason is, but that's generally that kind of idea about the did-not-dress list. But we don't know for sure. Okay. Mm-hmm. So they don't have the starter. The backup tries to make a tackle, I believe, on a punt return touchdown, and injures his shoulder, or maybe successfully made the tackle there, but injures his shoulder. So now the backup punter is out, and you're relying on a true freshman punter who is told kick the ball out of bounds, and instead kicks it straight down the middle of the field to a punt return man with 8 seconds left in the half who runs it back for a touchdown. So it kind of a crazy mistake. Now, a lot of factors that led to that. And then you add to that that, you know, K-State had, I think, multiple drives take place around or in front of, like, the Kansas 30. You know, just based off what the offense was doing and then, you know, having four 40-yard punt returns. So it was a calamity of a whole lot of things. But the defense, you know, if you want to talk a bright spot for Kansas, the defense standing up, holding Kansas State to field goals over and over and over until kind of things, you know, fell apart in the third quarter. That's really what I think we in media and I'm sure fans have seen this year with Kansas' defense. Against Oklahoma State, Kansas' defense gave up 47 points. They opened the game. They forced, I believe, a punt and a field goal in no particular order. And I think their offense averaged 1.8 yards per play through the first three quarters. Now, Josh, to give you an idea of how bad 1.8 yards per play is, do you know how many plays it would take you to get a first down averaging 1.8 yards per play?
I believe it would be six.
It would be six. So forget going for it on fourth down. Forget the imaginary fifth down. It would take you six plays to get a first down. That's 2-3 and outs. Just to get a first down. And so, you know, people complain about the defense, and it's like, well, the defense played 95 plays against Oklahoma State. Like, what do you, at a certain point, you know, a rubber band only goes so far before it snaps.
Right.
So that's where I've kind of looked at this Kansas defense over the last few weeks. It's not a great unit. It's not a very good unit. They've got a lot of issues. They were better against West Virginia, only allowed 38, had a couple takeaways. But if the offense isn't going to help and special teams is going to be a disaster, then it is impossible to fairly and accurately assess, criticize, judge the defense. Because you're essentially, it's the equivalent of, like, dousing firefighters in, like, gasoline, setting a match, and then being like, wow, they're really bad at putting out this fire. Like, you just lit them on fire. Like, what do you want them to do? Sorry for the horrifying visual there. But anyway, that would be my comparison.
We here at Sports Radio 810 do not endorse lighting firefighters on fire. Just to be clear, Scott may or may not. That's something he's going to have to, you can tweet him about that later. It's nice that you found a bright spot. That's encouraging. But let's go ahead and just get through three phases of the game before we go big picture. For all of the things that, you know, KU's defense, bright spot, firefighter who's been lit on fire, special teams, the fire itself. Where are we with KU's offense at this point? I mean, obviously, Puka Williams opting out adds a whole level to it. I at this point, like, I don't even know what to look at anymore because I'm just kind of waiting for something interesting to happen. And I don't know if there's something interesting today that I missed or something interesting I should be looking for. But right now, it just isn't very fun.
Yeah, no, you didn't miss anything interesting today. I can promise you that. I was at the game in Manhattan.
Was it worth the drive? The first question before the one that I actually asked.
Yeah, it is because Kansas State does this weird thing where they have like sweet tea in the press box, and I was inquiring to some folks how big of a donation. I'm a journalist, but how big a donation I would have to make to the Williams Fund to get that sweet tea at Kansas game?
Yeah,
because they claim it only has 18 like grams of sugar or something, but it tastes better than McAllister's Deli sweet tea. So I don't know if any of those people are sponsors, but you're welcome for free advertising there. So it was worth it in that regard. But
you drove to Manhattan for sweet tea and to be in person for one of the worst special teams performances of all time.
Maybe the worst special teams performance in the history of modern football.
Yeah.
Here's how I would kind of classify the offense. You've got a true freshman who's going to have limited plays and limited things he can do because he hasn't even turned 18 yet. He's not just a true freshman. He is a 17-year-old.
Crazy.
Who didn't get spring, who didn't get summer, who is now starting for this team, which is absolutely nuts. So I give him credit for what he's doing. And I think I put the quarterback, when I was describing their three quarterbacks, I put it this way. Thomas McVitie is their best quarterback for the now. Jalen Daniels has the most upside, and Miles Kendrick is behind in both aspects. So I think that's why you're seeing them go with Jalen Daniels. Now, not having Puka Williams-Hurst, not having Stephon Robinson, who I've had 7 or 8 touchdowns last year, he had ankle surgery that we found out today happened a few days ago, so he's going to be out. He's been injured, banged up all year. They didn't have T.K. Williams, their probably third-best wideout. They didn't have or fourth. They didn't have L.J. Arnold, their best freshman wideout. So that room has been absolutely decimated. But still, the biggest problem is with the offensive line. Kansas's tackles have been, I should say their tackle play has been atrocious. And, they have two guards, career guards, playing tackle. And that's not a normal transition. Like, that's a transition out of necessity and lack of bodies, not because they thought, oh, these guys are so great, like, let's move them to tackle. No, it was, hey, we don't have tackles, so we got to find someone. And that's, what Kansas, those kind of conversations were like. And they had other guys they liked, but one of them's injured, and the other one decided to opt out before the season, and now is in the transfer portal. So, you lose both your left and right tackles to one to the NFL, one to graduation, and then you lose two more, one to the transfer portal and, one to injury, and all of a sudden, you really don't have the depth there. So that line is just an absolute mess right now, and it creates a really tough situation for an offensive coordinator and Brent Bierman. I think there are a lot of fans that are frustrated with the offense, and I've seen some, I won't say a large portion, but I've seen some kind of criticize Bierman or, hey, why do they call so many bubble screens, or why do they do X, Y, and Z? And the thing I keep coming back to is, last year wasn't that long ago. I know it feels like it was when they were putting up 48 points twice, 31 points at Iowa State, 37 points against Texas Tech. I think 25 points against West Virginia or whatever. Like, you can look to last year and be like, yeah, this guy knows how to competently call games. You can look to his time at Bethel when he averaged 55 points a game and led the nation in scoring, and people can say, well, it's Bethel. But I would say, okay, then why doesn't everyone average 55 points a game if it's that easy to do it? No, he's a very good play caller. He's a very competent coach. But look what he's dealing with right now. He's dealing with a 17-year-old quarterback. He's dealing with an offensive line that might be the worst in the history of the Big 12. He's dealing with a receivers room that's been decimated by injury. He doesn't have Puka Williams. He's relying on a sophomore and a freshman at running back. Like, that's going to make it really hard. You could have Andy Reid calling the plays, and it's not going to look good. It's just going to be a problem spot. So for that reason, I think fans have to have a little bit more patience with the offense and understand that it looks really bad right now, and it probably is really bad right now. Mm-hmm. But that you don't really know what you have there as compared to the defense, which I think still at times looks really bad. But you're seeing young players like Karan Prunty, Stephen Parker, Kenny Logan. You're seeing a few young players actually look really sharp and maybe think you're building something there.
Specifically on Jalen Daniels, I mean, you mentioned obviously like highest upside of the room and everything. My general hunch, especially whenever you only have a guy for, 4 years in a typical, could get redshirted, could leave for the NFL a year early, whatever. But generally speaking, looking at 4 years for a class of guys, my inclination would be to try to just play the guy, especially if you're Kansas, right? You play the guy with the highest upside and try to develop him that way. But also you're talking about an offense where in this time, he's gaining an understanding of Dierman's offense that would probably be harder to do not playing, but you also have to wonder a little bit about, with his supporting cast, with that offensive line being as decimated as you just described, do you like that they're rolling with Jalen Daniels right now? Do you think that it should be his job the remainder of the year? What would you do given the keys to the quarterback room?
Look, I thought he took a step forward today. From his first two performances, which I actually thought were bad. And I'm on record as saying if his performances had been as bad as the first full start he got, that there was very little value to playing him because he got hit 15 times. He completed basically no difficult passes after his first drive. He wasn't quarterbacking them down the field, successful drives or anything like that. And I feel like at that point, there's a like kind of diminishing return to that what you're getting. And you risk shattering the guy's confidence in getting him injured, which, by the way, he did get injured. And his second start, it was like an ankle injury as well. However, I thought he showed some flashes, some signs of progress. And it seemed like there was a point where they did open up the offense and let him do a little bit more, which is important. It's equally important not to put too much on him right now because we've seen at times he throws with short throws. Like, one, the screen that was intercepted today, he threw across his body, lost at the ball, terrible throw. And I know people, that kind of goes back to the Dearman thing, right? People wonder, like, well, why are they calling that play? Well, Les Miles said after the game, that wasn't the play. That wasn't the read. And apparently Brent Dearman went over and spoke to him after that. So that's another example of, you know, you've got a freshman quarterback trying to digest an offense. A 17-year-old freshman, and he didn't have the spring. He wasn't an early enrollee because, well, no one was an early enrollee, essentially, because not having spring ball. So it just makes it makes it really tricky. And so I think at this point you probably stick with him. I am of the belief that Thomas McVitie gives Kansas the best chance to win games, and may next year as well, because everyone gets this year of eligibility back, but if they think that Jalen Daniels in year two would be comparable to Thomas McVitie in year five, if they get him the reps and experience, then I think you have to be all for that just because he's a guy that in theory could have 5 years of eligibility after this season if he redshirts at some point. And for a program that's looked for a quarterback for a long time, kind of found one last year in a senior, I think that's really important. So I'm not 100% sure he'll be the last quarterback to start a game or the only quarterback who plays the rest of the way, but I think it's very clear that Kansas would rather have him playing, certainly than Myles Kendrick, who got the start in the last game.
Let's kind of take the 30,000-foot view again, and you know, I don't want to assume that everyone heard the last time we talked about a lot of these things, but so you kind of unpacked a little bit of how you expected this year to actually look worse for Kansas football than last year did, because this is the barest cabinet year for Les Miles, and then after this year things start coming together, you start expecting to see steps of growth. But I believe that your viewpoint at this point is that you want to see real growth, not even next year, but the year after. It's a long rebuild. That is theoretically what KU knew was coming, as they kind of rebounded from David Beatty having a bunch of JUCO guys and all that. So I certainly don't expect you to have any wholesale changes in what your expectations were from today's game. But I do think that we're seeing kind of a lot of people questioning a lot of things with Les Miles and KU right now, and I figured you'd have something to say about that.
Yeah, well, look, I'll say this. I wouldn't call it uninformed, because people are tired of watching Kansas for a long time and hearing the same thing. You know, give it 2 years, give it 2 years, give it 2 years. And that's their right. And also, if you've tuned out the program and you aren't reading as much, you aren't listening to as much, whatever, who could blame you?
Don't blame anyone. This absolutely. 100%. Yep. If you're national media and your focus isn't the Big 12 and all you have are jokes about Kansas, I totally get it. That's all they've earned for a decade. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm not going to fault anyone for that. I think that'd be really unfair. But I would just say this. Les Miles, in my opinion, was the right coach to hire from Kansas, specifically from the reason of this was probably, whoever took over the job, a 3-year rebuild in terms of getting a full and complete roster. Now, the COVID stuff may actually end up changing that because of seniors being able to return, and we'll see how that all works out. But understanding that the roster that Les Miles took over had like 60 scholarship seniors and like basically no freshmen and sophomores, very few. And the reason being that David Beatty went so JUCO heavy, whether it was out of necessity, whether it was out of trying to save his job by winning, or maybe he, you know, at a certain point just couldn't recruit high schoolers. He only had one commit when Les Miles took over. One. So that tells you, you take 25 in a class. That tells you that they were having some problems. And that was like a month out of signing day, by the way. So that was not like, oh, he had one commit, but it was June. It was like, no, it was like November. But that kind of speaks to the state of it. Les Miles' job has been recruit high school talent, get the program back to 85 scholarships, and then you start to build. So year one, you still had all the JUCO guys, whatever. Kansas won 3 games. You could make the argument they very easily could have beat Coastal Carolina, 12-7 loss. They led Texas in the fourth quarter and lost. They led Iowa State in the fourth quarter and lost. They lost by 5 to West Virginia. That easily could have been a 5-6 or 7 win team. Now, that would have required every single play going their way. But, I mean, they just on games alone, they led in the fourth quarter. they could have picked up two more wins. So that's not, you know, whatever. But then you lose all those guys, and what do you replace them with? Well, you replace them with 17-year-olds and 25 or 26 high school freshmen who some are playing, some look good, but some are not. And because of Les Miles' limited first class due to decisions made by David Beatty to overload on the front end, Les Miles did not take any offensive linemen in his first recruiting class, 2019 scholarship, because they didn't have the space to do it, and they had other needs. And the idea was that maybe you'd have some guys mature and be ready to go this year. That clearly hasn't been the case. Now, injury and again, the transfer situation hasn't helped, or the opt-out situation. But the idea is that you took 25 names in 2020, you'll take 20 more in 2021, 20 more in 2022, and now all of a sudden you've got this complete roster. So the blueprint that I've always been working off of in terms of how I've measured what this program should do in the rebuild is this year is going to be a disaster. 2021, you want to see progress. 2022, you need to win four games. 2023, you need to win six games. And four games sounds like the lowest bar in the world, but Kansas hasn't done it since 2009. Four games would be a huge deal for this program. So if next year they win two or three games, but they're competitive throughout, and then they win four games the next year, and then they're bowl eligible in 2023, I don't care if what Les Miles' record would be at that point. That would be, in my opinion, an unquestioned success and validation that he was the right hire, so long as, one, he sticks to high school-only recruiting. I have no reason to believe Les Miles is going to, for the first time in his life, start recruiting JUCO players because he's afraid of losing his job. I promise you he's secure enough to not have to worry about that. And two, as long as recruits keep listening and hearing his message, because if recruits don't want to commit to Kansas, you know, because of how bad they are, then it doesn't matter if your coach is Les Miles, Dabo Sweeney, Nick Saban. It doesn't matter if you can't get them to commit. Yeah. So as long as he continues to build the way he has, then, yes, the results will be awful this year, and some of them will be bad next year. However, I think you'll see things start to turn in a couple years, you know, assuming the world still exists. And that's kind of when I would think you would start to see the progress. It's going to be a bumpy road, and it's going to be hard for Kansas fans who have waited way too long to see competent football. It's going to be a long road to see them put up with it. But I tell you what, if Kansas had won those 50-50 games last year, and I'm talking about leading Iowa State in the fourth quarter, leading Texas with like a minute to play, you know, if they had won five games last year, or, you know, somehow beat Coastal Carolina and won six games last year, I think people would feel so much differently about this year, but I get it. It probably doesn't feel very good to be a Kansas football fan right now, and you can certainly understand and empathize with people who feel that way.
And we could just cut that audio and could have played that at any point from the last decade. And now you're saying that basically by the time the next election cycle sort of kicks into gear, KU should be borderline bowl eligible. That should be their expectation.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, it's when the third Supreme Court judge is after the next election, about then will be the time. Then it'll all be fixed.
And not the midterms. They're still going to be bad at midterms. But the next presidential election cycle, there'll be some primaries and stuff. By then, KU should win some games. Thank you, Scott. Always good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Chasen of 24/7 Sports and Fog.net. You go to kansas.247sports.com and get all the work there. Or, again, just Fog.net. Please, for the love of God, follow Scott on Twitter at Chasen Scott. It's Sports Saturday here on Sports Radio 810. I'm Josh Briscoe. More show next. Welcome back to Sports Saturday here on Sports Radio 810. The song playing right now is a certified bop, as the kids say. It'll kick in a second. You're going to let this play. Unless you're on the podcast, then you can go. There it is. This song is great. And if you don't like this song, you're a hater or you're lying. This is from the New Glass Animals album. And I found out about it a couple days ago. We'll talk to Matt Verderam here in like 2 minutes. We'll have a quick segment here, then we'll get to Verderam. This whole album crushes. This song is called Heat Waves. And I had no idea that this album was so good until I just sort of stumbled into it on Spotify a couple days ago. Yesterday. And I've been listening to it. I probably listened to it five times. I don't listen to albums just like on loop like that. The whole vibe of this album is incredible to me.
to the point where I thought it might be like, you got to be in the right, sometimes you got to be in the right headspace for an album, and then it just kind of like washes over you, whatever. I was not in a particularly, you could say, vibey mood whenever I was started listening to it. And it like turned my whole night around. All of a sudden, my whole night was about this album. Again, it's called Dreamland by Glass Animals. I'm not a huge Glass Animals fan previously. Like, it's been fine. This album absolutely hit me. Jason, you don't like it.
Well, I don't mind this. This is, I think Glass Animals may end up being an important band. I hear,
I wish you could see me dancing.
I hear really interesting stuff in there. I think it's the beginning of something, and I want to like it.
Yeah.
But I don't like it. I can listen to it, but I don't turn it on and go, "This is fantastic."
And you're not seeking it out.
You know, I was telling you earlier, I feel that way about Led Zeppelin. I think Led Zeppelin was a really important band. I think they changed things. You know, they stole a lot. But I think they're important, and I have no problem listening to them, but I never seek them out to listen to them, you know?
Yeah.
I'm kind of the same way with jazz. I think jazz was an important form of music, especially in Kansas City. Oh, my gosh, it's important. And it spawned so much other stuff, including Glass Animals. But I don't ever seek out jazz, and Glass Animals had, maybe this is partially because Glass Animals had a song out called Scylla that I liked a lot. I went and I bought the album. I had to go all the way to Louisville to find the album, and then Scylla wasn't
really
on the album.
Oh.
So I might just be mad about that.
Might just be mad still. Have you listened to 100 Gex at all?
No.
100 Gex is extremely weird. And their album of remixes is actually probably a little more palatable to sort of the average. Not that you are the average music listener, but to the general average music listener. It's extremely strange, and I gave it a couple of passes through a couple of days ago, finally. The album is called 1000 Gex, G-E-C-S, 1000 Gex. Also,
like geckos?
G-E-C-S. I don't know what it's... I'm not nearly deep enough in the lore to speak to any of that. But that has been the weirdest thing that I've listened to recently that I think, honestly, I might have just wanted to take that and make it a little more normal but keep a very kind of vaporwave vibe, and that's where Dreamland was perfect for me. I'm not sure. It's weird, and I'm kind of here for it. I'm 1,000% here for Dreamland, and I'm angry at everyone who didn't tell me how good this album was 2 months ago whenever it came out. But if you tried to tell me and I just didn't, like, see your tweet or whatever, you can stay. Matt Verderam is next on Sports Radio 810. Welcome back in the Sports Saturday on Sports Radio 810. Matt Verderam in moments. Jason, how do you feel about Half Alive?
I like this a lot.
Okay. I feel like there's a Venn diagram. I feel like there's a Venn diagram where Half Alive and Glass Animals actually overlap a little bit.
I can see that, but here's another band. I like this
Matt,
a lot.
Matt, hold
I'm an
on,
old
Matt.
Band.
We're
I
want to
buy the album on CD. It's not available.
That's weird. That's fine. I think Glass Animals sit somewhere between Half Alive and Alt-J.
Yes.
On that spectrum there?
Yes. And this,
I feel
like
pretty good
this
about
end
that.
Of the spectrum the best.
That's fair. I would have thought Glass Animals was close enough to this. At least Dreamland. But that's very good. We can continue. I don't know. What are we going to call our music podcast? Jason and Josh just joshing about music with Matt Verderam of Fanside joins us now. Follow him on Twitter at Matt Verderam. Matt, I don't think, have we ever talked about music? What are you generally bumping whenever it's not great things like the Arrowhead Addict podcast, which you can listen to. You can hear Matt Verderam talk about the Chiefs on a, I think, twice weekly basis, right?
Right after the game. And then usually we do it Thursday afternoon, kind of preview the next week.
So if you're not listening to the Arrowhead Addict podcast, what are you listening to? That's not talk. What is your music preference?
I'm probably going to surprise anybody who has ever heard me on this. I am not a huge music guy, but I'll listen to like Green Day. I'm a huge Goo Goo Dolls fan.
Interesting. That is a bit of a curveball, but it all kind of clocks.
I like, you know, I love U2. Saw them in concert a few years ago in Chicago. Awesome. Aerosmith. And then I'm more of that. Like, if it's been created in the last 15 years, I probably don't listen to it. And not because I'm one of these old, I just don't really listen to radio quite a bit. I usually, you know, whatever's on my iPhone. You know, I don't, I don't listen. You know, I love like Cranberries, like more Pearl Jam, Nirvana, stuff like that.
I still maintain, at some point I need to confront my dad about this, which is an interesting way to start a sentence, that I think there's at least a decent...
It sounds like something you ought to be saying in therapy. You're charging $150 an hour.
I know. I'll Venmo you for these next 2 minutes. I still think there's a decent chance that I, at least through my dad's eyes, was named after the album Joshua Tree. Not the location, but the album. My dad's a huge U2 guy. There's like a big Joshua Tree poster like in our basement. I think there's a decent chance that is directly overlapped. So, yeah.
I'll argue that the greatest music video of all time is Where the Streets Have No Name, when they're on top of, I think it's the Tower Records in L.A., and they're just playing this impromptu concert.
Yeah.
And people just climbing up the light poles, and the cops are trying to keep it under control. And it's awesome. But, yeah, I think maybe it's just initially like a week ago. When I used to play hockey in high school, you know, we'd have like a half hour before games, and we'd have to sit in the locker room. We'd wait for a coach to come in and kind of go over the last minute strategy. And I would always have to calm myself down and be solved for the game that I would sit there and listen to like symphony music and actually fall asleep before the game.
That's so
like,
good.
I'd listen to like the theme of like Jurassic Park. And that would totally calm me down. I'd fall asleep on the bench, like waiting to play the game. And then I'd come out. Get out there for the game. They play the anthem, and I'd be ready to try to inflict as much damage as humanly possible.
That's so good. I love that you're in full uniform, just da na 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 na. That's so good.
I'd listen like a piano concerto, and just pass. I literally would try to go to sleep because otherwise, just solid for the game. I'd take a penalty like 2 minutes into the game.
That's because you would murder someone. Because you would.
I had bad intentions.
That's so good.
So, yeah, it was a way for me to kind of calm down before I play.
Love that. There's a variety. We don't have a ton of time here today, which is, we'll blast through several topics. We'll get to some Chiefs stuff here as well. But we just haven't talked in a few weeks, and because we haven't had as many almost entirely sportses. We should have some more soon and talk to Matt more regularly. But we've just seen a lot of things. A lot of games have happened in the NFL. A lot of teams have won and teams have lost. I don't know if there's been some, like, shift in power. I think we kind of saw the Chiefs restabilize after losing to the Raiders. Has anything recently moved the needle for you? Maybe the Buccaneers, and obviously now adding Antonio Brown?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, Tampa beating the Packers the way they did,
yeah,
that has to at least say, hey, the Bucs are a real team. Because I think going into that game, I kind of looked at it as the Packers the best team in the NFC, and then probably Seattle, then Tampa. Now, I also believe strongly in the NFL, even though it's just a small sample size, 16 games in the playoffs, like one game does not make a team, one way or the other. So I still think Green Bay is a really, really good team. I think they are going to lay it on the Texans tomorrow afternoon. But with the Buccaneers, let's be real. They got a great defense, and I don't know how I feel about Antonio Brown. Like, on one hand, I get it, he's really talented. That's also the kind of thing that could end up just being a complete disaster by Thanksgiving. So, I think to me, there's 16 to go in the Super Bowl. Tampa, Green Bay, and Seattle in the NFC, and then Kansas City, Pittsburgh, and Baltimore in the NFC. Those 16. If you want to argue Tennessee, I'll hear the argument. But to me, those are the teams. I don't see anybody else coming in and all of a sudden muscling their way into the conversation.
Pittsburgh is interesting. That's sort of the team that jumps out to me from that list, just because I don't disagree, but I'm also – I don't know how I would make the argument for the Steelers belonging in that group. Well, what have you seen from them that's convinced you?
Oh, their defense is ridiculous.
Yeah, fair.
I mean, my argument would be their pass rush is just unreal. Now, the Steelers are interesting. They blitz more than anybody in football, but they don't really have to. Hmm. But they've got Cam Hayward and Dupree and Watt. But they don't have to blitz as much as they do, but they do. They bring a ton of pressure. However, they are worst in the league on third and long defensively, which is kind of weird. Hmm. But that's something to keep an eye on. Offensively, I think they're somewhat limited. Claypool's been awesome.
Yeah.
As a rookie at Notre Dame, but they're not necessarily explosive offensively. Roethlisberger's played a lot, like Breeze has this year, a lot of checkdowns, let guys make plays after the catch. But that deep, to me, they are the biggest problem, and I hesitate to say this maybe, but I think they're the only problem to the Chiefs in the AFC. Because that defense can be such a problem. Now, losing Devin Bush for the year is a major blow. And if they blitz the Chiefs will kill them.
Right.
But that team has, Fitzpatrick could guard Kelsey. They've got guys who can get pressure one-on-one. They, to me, are the biggest challenger to Kansas City.
This is really weirdly specific because, I mean, you know, you've sort of said the Ravens you're not that worried about. And so the fact that I'm going to the third team in the AFC North is kind of odd. But I just wanted to talk to somebody about the Browns for like 2 weeks now, because whenever they lost, and obviously their two losses have been to the two teams in the division that are better than them, I think, yep, by every metric. There's just been a sort of anger or maybe excitement in like launching them out as total frauds and as, you know, like burying Baker Mayfield. I don't think the Browns are an incredible team by any means. I think asking a lot of questions about Baker is totally fair. But some of the stuff that happened after they got blown out by a team that you respect as much as the Steelers, I honestly felt like people were being kind of unfair to Cleveland. Is that insane? Am I wrong?
First of all, nobody's ever been unfair to the city of Cleveland.
to the football team that plays in the city of Cleveland.
At one point. So
that's fair.
Nobody's ever been unfair to the city of Cleveland.
That's
Second
fair.
Second of all, no, listen, I think the Browns are what they are. They're a quality team that's not on the level of top-tier teams.
Yeah.
They're not as good as Kansas City, Baltimore, Pittsburgh, Tennessee, and I would even say Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
But are they as good as anybody else in the conference? Yeah, they probably are. I don't think the Browns are a bad team, but here's the problem with the Browns, and the Steelers and Ravens are perfectly tailored to expose it. When they can't run the ball and they get in situations where it's obvious passing down, second and long, specifically third and long, Mayfield is just not built to play those downs.
Mm-hmm.
He is very much the kind of a guy who needs play action, a defined read. And if you watch that Pittsburgh game, I sat down and watched it. That was a game I was actually going to write my column about before it turned into a blowout. You know, like that pass to Fitzpatrick, he just panicked. I mean, third down, they dropped Fitzpatrick down as like a lurker in the middle of the field. He picked it off and took off. So the Browns, look, the Browns are going to beat most bad teams they play because the Browns are talented, especially
mm-hmm.
offensively. But they're not yet of the quality as our teams. But if you're a Browns fan, that's fine. For the last 20 years, you just finished watching.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that tracks. And you said you're kind of waiting to hear the argument in full on Tennessee being among those like six legit contenders. I continue to be impressed by them and also a little suspicious for some reason that I don't know that I can fully explain.
So here's my problem with Tennessee. Let me start out. Here's what I like about Tennessee. Tannehill is excellent play action, and he's been very good.
Mm-hmm.
Just period, since he's been the starter, he's been excellent. Henry's ridiculous. Henry's the one outlier. You know, people are like, oh, running backs don't matter. He matters because he is such a bear to deal with
mm-hmm.
that he causes you to play defense differently. And Vrabel's done a great job. The problem I have with Tennessee is outside of the Bills game, they have played the dregs of the league. They played Denver, they won by 2 points.
Mm-hmm.
They played Minnesota, they won by a point. They played Jacksonville at home, they won by 3 points. They played Houston, they needed to go to overtime. And I believe two of those games were home. Like that to me is concerning. They're not putting that, they beat the daylights out of Buffalo, so give them credit there. But their defense ranks at the bottom or close to it in almost every metric. That worries me when they play a really good team and a team like Pittsburgh tomorrow, who's mm-hmm. just going to fly out, so you are not running football. You're not going to run the ball. You're going to have to beat us throwing it in second and third long. I don't know that they're built to do it. So that's my problem with Tennessee. I think when they play teams like them, like Kansas City, like Baltimore, they're going to be in situations where those teams are just going to say, we don't care. You're going to have to throw it to beat us, and you're going to have to throw an obvious passing down. I don't know Tennessee's got the capability to do it. I know Kansas City can do that. I know Pittsburgh mm-hmm. can do it. I don't know that Tennessee can.
You know the gif of Bugs Bunny sawing off the state of Florida that shows up?
Yeah, I wish it was real life.
Florida in this instance, not the actual victim that I'm thinking of. Could we do that to the NFC East? Because it's bonkers. It is mathematically difficult to see a division where the top team, the team leading the division, is 2-4-1.
It's a complete embarrassment. It is so bad. Like, I'm not even one of these. You always hear this argument when a team or a division is bad. You always hear, well, should the NFL change, you know, playoff format?
Mm.
And I always say no, because come on, how often does it really happen? You know, you want a team out of each division. I understand that. This, honestly, this is embarrassing for the NFL. You're going to have a team that's going to get it. I really think is going to win six games.
Mm-hmm.
Like, these teams are so bad. I don't even see, like, hope. Like, sometimes, you know, a division starts out bad. You say, ah, okay, that team's going to get a bunch of guys back. Who's the argument for that? I mean, maybe Philly?
Maybe.
Do you want to argue maybe the Eagles getting the fight back on seven games?
Yeah.
That division is atrocious. This is going to be the first time in NFL history that some team tanks for the 5 seed.
Right.
Like, teams are going to be actively losing, trying to lose their division to get the 5 seed. I really went into the season saying the NFC was the much better conference. I got to tell you, the AFC is a far better conference than the NFC. The AFC has teams that would just whack the hell out of most of these teams in the NFC. I think the best teams in the league are all in the AFC. All of them, the possible exception of Tampa.
You think Tampa's that good? You're that in? The Packers game did that much for you?
Excuse me. I'm not that in. That's why I said possibly. I got to see how it comes together. Here's my problem with Tampa. And I don't know if it's a problem, but a concern. They are also a team very much like Pittsburgh. They blitz as much as anybody in the league.
Mm-hmm.
When you blitz that much, and Baltimore, we saw this with the Chiefs week three on Monday night. When you blitz that much, you run the risk of just getting absolutely blitzed and bombed by another team. And I wonder when Tampa plays somebody that has more than one weapon, like how does that work? Like when they play a Chiefs in a month,
mm-hmm.
what does that look like? Because I got to tell you, like, nothing against Carlton Davis. He's not guarding Tyreek Hill one-on-one.
Right.
Like, what does that look like? And they're so good against the run. But a team like Kansas City, they don't care.
Right.
It's great. You can stop the run. That's fantastic. We're going to throw the ball 50 times.
Right.
So I think Tampa is really good. But I think Kansas City is better than anybody in the NFC. I think Pittsburgh is better than anybody in the NFC. I think Baltimore is an argument for being better than anybody in the NFC. But it's a stacked conference. The AFC is really, really good this year.
Again, just as we haven't talked in the last couple of weeks, we've had two really different performances from the Chiefs with everything that happened against the Raiders. They got beat over the top by Derek Carr, and then they did not get beat in any way by Josh Allen. We saw a much more aggressive defense in terms of blitzing Josh Allen. That worked. Not blitzing Derek Carr didn't. The pass rush was simply not good enough in that game. It's just with the secondary against the Raiders. Whatever. I mean, they're just so many places those two games looked nothing alike. What did you learn in that duo with both good and bad from the Chiefs?
Well, not to sound like an apologist for the Chiefs, but in the Raiders game, I can't say the full phrase on the radio, but you know what happens.
Right.
Like, it happens.
Right.
They won 13 games in a row, including the Super Bowl. Like, sometimes, you know, they busted coverage. I mean, if you went back and watched that game, I did. And you watched the team that I think, frankly, mentally was a little bit adrift in the game.
Mm-hmm.
The secondary uncharacteristically blew coverage. And give the Raiders credit. The pass rush was nullified. It was a good offensive line. The Chiefs, you know, when they had the opportunity to get off the field, a lot of times it was those big plays that beat them deep. That kind of stuff kills you. If you're the Chiefs, you don't care if another team has a drive here or there, but you can't give up the huge quick strike touchdown. That's the thing that's going to hurt you when you have an offense like this. And I thought offensively, look, the Chiefs bogged down in the second half of the game. They didn't play particularly well. But, you know, the line wasn't good, but Mahomes also drifted, which caused, you know, even further issues. That said, I thought the Chiefs really reestablished themselves in Buffalo. I mean, they ran the ball about as well as you'll ever see them run the football. And they did what they needed to do. The Pats and the Raiders had essentially said, look, beat us running the ball. We're going to drop seven guys every play.
Mm-hmm.
And the Chiefs refused to run. Well, they finally did run. And now that poses an interesting question here with the Bills, with the Broncos. How do the Broncos play the Chiefs after watching that film?
Yeah.
Are the Broncos also going to drop off and drop back and say, all right, we're gonna let you run the ball again? Or do they try to be a little bit more aggressive with run blitzes and stuff like that? I think Kansas City matches up really, really well with Denver. But, you know, Fangio played them twice last year. Chiefs beat them bad both times last season. I would expect it. You know, the Broncos are going to throw some wrinkles. This is a huge game for Denver. So, you know, the Chiefs need to come right.
One thing that I imagine they have to be asking in Denver to figure out what their plan was, they were asking this week, was the offensive line performance that we saw against Buffalo legitimate? I mean, Nick Allegretti gets his first meaningful set of career snaps. Daniel Kilgore gets the start at center. Mike Remmers is at right tackle. And Reed said that same offensive line will be the one that starts against Denver. What did you think about that performance and what you're willing to assume that means going forward?
I thought it was very good, but I think there has to be a few qualifiers. So Nick Allegretti watching that game looked like John Hannah. Okay, now why is that? Is that because Nick Allegretti actually is John Hannah? Probably.
Yes.
Not.
Yes. Next question. Thank you, Matt. Oh, okay. Sorry. Maybe not. Okay.
But the Bills were begging the Chiefs to run the ball.
Yes.
I mean, begging them. They were. You watched the replay. I mean, there are times literally eight guys are dropping 10 yards off the line of scrimmage. I mean, they are just dying for the Chiefs to run the ball, and Kansas City did it. And now, this is where me credit comes into the O line. They did their job. I mean, there were huge holes, and they did a nice job. The one thing I think it does carry over is they did a very good job of getting to the second level over and over and over and over and over. That is something that I do think they have the athleticism to do that should carry over. But this is, I think it's a good line. Certainly they want Schwartz back. Nothing against Mike Remmers, but Schwartz is the best right tackle in football, and he's right. So I do think there's a very good chance that Allegretti and Kilgore are going to stick.
Yeah.
That, I think, is a very real possibility. But Denver's got Shelby Harris inside. He's a very good player. They got Chubb on the edge, who's a very good player. And I would suspect that Denver's not going to be willing to give up 245 rushing yards. So the Chiefs are going to have to play a little differently. But I think the line played very well. But, yeah, I mean, look, you have to be honest and keep in mind that they were dropping basically 12 guys every play. So, you know, at some point, yeah, you're going to have some lanes.
Matt, in a good little 30-second package, tell everybody everything you're doing at FanSided, Stacking the Box, the podcast, the column, the Airhood Addict podcast. Where can people find all your work?
Well, you pretty much said it. I
got it memorized at this point.
I mean, Stack the Box column every Monday morning, quarterback rankings, power rankings on Tuesday morning. Wednesday, do this new column now. The whole NFL in 1,000 words. Breaks down three keys for every single game. Really deep dive statistics, and then picks on Thursdays. The Stack the Box podcast goes up Sunday night and Wednesday afternoon. And the Arrowhead podcast goes up right after whatever the Chiefs play, and then on Thursday afternoon. So if you want to bother me on Twitter, go ahead. I'm always ready to either have a good conversation or just fight somebody.
Yep, go fight about you two or whatever it takes with Matt Verderam on Twitter, at Matt Verderam on Twitter. Matt, thank you as always, and thanks for joining us on a Saturday this time.
Always happy to do it.
Matt Verderam, FanSided, Stacking the Box, all the things. Just go to Matt Verderam on Twitter, at Matt Verderam. We're nearly out of time here on Sports Saturday. I'll tell you what's coming up, though, the rest of the afternoon here, really the rest of the evening here on Sports Radio 810. Coverage of Game 4 of the World Series kicks off right after we wrap up here in just a couple of minutes. The Rays would like to even the series back up again now, down 2-1 to the Dodgers. Over on ESPN Kansas City, the Sporting Kansas City game begins at 8:30. That's over on 1510 AM and 94.5 FM. Plus, everything we've talked about there with the Chiefs and Broncos tomorrow. Coverage for Chiefs Broncos starts at the crack of dawn tomorrow morning here on Sports Radio 810. The Central Bank of the Midwest pregame show starts at noon, but we'll have Chiefs and NFL stuff all day long as the game tomorrow kicks off at 3:25. And then immediately after the game, Sports Radio 810 WHB postgame show with yours truly begins, brought to you by Missouri Lottery and CBD American Shaman. I imagine we're going to have a few interesting storylines that we either say, all right, this is for real, or this is still up in the air, looking at the Chiefs pass rush, looking at the secondary, looking at the offensive line. There just aren't a lot of questions about, like, Patrick Mahomes at this point. Although, maybe here's something to keep an eye on. Tyreek Hill's been quiet for a minute now. Not because he's not getting separation, because he's getting all the attention in the world. So keep an eye on that. And while we're plugging Twitter accounts, you can tweet me, follow me at JB Briscoe. I will talk to you again on Sunday. Thanks to the Drake, Jason Justice, for next man up all the way to where the starter's back in the lineup again. I'll talk to you tomorrow afternoon. Enjoy all the NFL, all the sports, and we'll talk to you then. Bye, Mom.